Hello, baseball nuts, and a big warm welcome to episode 7, Seventh Heaven of the Johnny and Josh Show. What a pleasure to have your company. And on this very day that we're recording, August the 30th, back in 1905, in his first major league at-bat, 18-year-old center fielder Ty Cobb starts his hitting career with a double. And we've got some Ty Cobbs of our own on the show. Great pleasure to welcome JC, Big Dave, and Eric, the producer. Hi, boys. Lovely to have you.
That was the start of the nastiest career in baseball history. Is this the start of like the nastiest podcast?
It was like a podcast.
Hopefully, we're all a little done, bit less racist.
Yeah, let's not go in spikes up, guys.
Yeah, yeah. Mr. Cobb, not a great ball player, but not the nicest person from all accounts. Fond memories of how he was described by Todd the Moose Man Macklid, but because this is a family show, I can't reference it. Guys, very quickly, COVID update. We thought we had our first week with nothing but good news, and I'm afraid to say, literally, as we are about to broadcast, as we're about to transmit, there is news that the Oakland A's, someone in the organisation has tested positive, and tonight's game for the Athletics has been postponed.
Let's hope that it's someone who is a little attenuated from the players on the field, and that this is just a quick postponement in order to make sure that no one else, none of the players on the roster have anything and they can move on.
A little depressing, right? I mean, we think that we're getting into a little bit of a rhythm. We've got it behind us, but just another sign that you're never safe, and that will go all the way through until the last out of the World Series.
But, well, guys, I suppose it's easy to be negative in these very difficult times for a lot of people with regards to COVID, but obviously this week has also been, in a negative sense, we yet another issue in the States, yet another shooting. And I've got to say how proud I am of baseball's response. A number of teams over a couple of days deciding not to play, to say enough is enough, and sport using its voice in a very positive way.
The truth is that the devil's in the details on this, Gouldy. So when I hear Clayton Kershaw talk about Mookie Betts, you know, I am really heartened by that. It was great. You know, he said all the right things. He was so positive of his teammates, so positive of the Black Lives Matter. What we need to see from baseball is some of what's going on with the NBA, and that they're going to need to really make some very strong efforts and not just make it, hey, look, we put up something on our social media, or we even canceled a game. That's just not enough. So I want to watch closely, and my great hope is that Major League Baseball now backs up what they're saying with some really positive action.
Just a button on what Josh said. One tweet I read, I can't remember who wrote it, said, when Major League Baseball does a deal with a fertilizer company, you get a press release that's like 10 pages long. And in this case, we had a press release that was just about a paragraph. So I think that sums up how much work needs to be done for Major League Baseball to capitalize on these moments and move the sport forward.
We're all going to have more about this later on in the show, because we have a nice interview from David with the curator of the Negro League Museums. And basically, we're going to hopefully address this more.
And, of course, this week was the 75th anniversary of the breaking of the color barrier. So there are some big stories which we, as you rightly say, Eric, we will be covering.
And we'll have more about that later on the show.
Well, guys, to make sure we finish off this introduction on a positive note, on this day, the 30th of August, 2004, Chipper Jones and his lovely wife, Sharon, welcomed their second child, a son, into the world, and they named him Shay in honor, Dave, of his absolute demolition of the New York Mets. Your team, he used to go to Shay and he smashed those home runs as if it was fun.
And it was. And obviously, Shay was a very important place for him because late in the season, the Braves were playing their final game at Shea Stadium. This would have been 2008. I got up super, super early with a camera crew to just shoot some beauty shots of Shea. I know you think that's not possible because a lot of people think Shea was a dump, which it was, but loved the place regardless. So I wanted to have the kind of record of the place. And there was Chipper Jones and his entire family walking around Shea Stadium for one final time, going everywhere in the ballpark. And I asked him why. He said, you know, I love the place, and I just wanted to show them one last time this fabulous cathedral of baseball where I just destroyed the dreams of Mets fans every single night.
Right, where I owned people.
Yeah, it was ridiculous.
Just killed them.
Awesome. Well, right. Eric, you've got the trivia question before us. Move on.
I do indeed. Basically, we're still in the middle of this. Well, I think we're already halfway through this crazy 60-game schedule, which would have impacted anyone who's trying to break Cal Ripken's consecutive games winning streak, wouldn't it?
But winning streak? You mean playing streak?
Playing streak, winning streak. Yeah. 2001. Johnny could have probably take me through how many, because he knows it by heart, how many consecutive games in a row did Cal Ripken Jr. play?
It was either 3,236 or 2,632. I can never remember why. Which one was it?
That's correct. So 2,632 consecutive games in a row.
16 and a half years.
Okay. So let me finish. So since then, the only player that's come closer was Miguel Tejada with 1,152 games in a row.
Very good.
So basically, I'm asking you now, my question to you is, since Miguel Tejada, which player has a record for most consecutive games in a row in the past 20 years?
Wow. Is it,
I have multiple choice because we've got multiple people here.
Oh,
all right?
Yes, great.
So which player in the past 20 years – since Miguel Tejada has played the most consecutive games in a row in Major League Baseball. Is it A, Hideki Matsui?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it B,
Hideki Matsui?
Ichiro.
Is it B?
It's always Ichiro.
Is it B, A-Rod? Or is it C, Prince Fielder?
Ooh.
So A, Hideki Matsui, B, A-Rod, C, Prince Fielder. Who has play the most consecutive games in a row in Major League Baseball in the past 20 years?
Very good question, Eric.
Answer later on in the show.
Prince Fielder ate a lot of consecutive meals. That I do know.
He was a vegetarian, wasn't he?
That is so wrong.
A-Rod looked in the mirror consecutive times more than any other baseball player.
Absolutely.
So moving on from that trivia question now, leave you in suspense. Our first pitch, our leadoff batter, our first topic of conversation is about oddball pitchers. Because let's face it, pitchers are renowned for being eccentrics, an oddball breed. And Josh, we've had an oddball moment this week, hadn't we?
Well, we actually had two oddball moments that related to pitchers. And I'm actually going to start this with an argument, which is that there's so much talk about favorite players should be positional players who play with flair and character. And I'm going to say, we really need to be looking at pitchers who have flair and character. And there were two great examples this week. One was Zach Greinke, who in the middle of a game, there was an issue with the mound. And so the grounds crew had to come out and they had to fix up the mound. And he just sort of sauntered behind the mound, sat down cross-legged and just hung out like it was at camp. You know, it was like he was 13 years old, just chilling in the middle of a Major League Baseball game. And I know we'll talk a little bit more about Greinke's background, but he is the most unique pitcher in baseball. I think that is easily arguable, and I love him. Second one is Trevor Bauer. So Trevor Bauer, who is a social media giant, and certainly takes his fair share of gruff and dishes it out, had complained that Budweiser had given a lot of props to Sonny Gray for the start of his season. So he made a deal with Budweiser that if he could strike out a certain number of batters over two games, that they would create Cincinnati Buds, a special Budweiser can that would represent the success that he had had and also recognize the Cincinnati Reds. So when he gets that final strikeout, he turns around, he mimics opening up a beer and drinking it and writes Buds on the back of the mound, which is just seemingly very different, big character. So I love it. I love both those guys. You know, Trevor Bauer definitely is a complicated character. He's, you know, one of a kind. But Greinke is just amazing. And Dave, I know we were both reading an article, a great oral history on him.
Yeah.
What was your favorite story about Greinke?
I just love how he gets away with being bluntly honest with his teammates about everything from their performance to, you know, the way they behave in a clubhouse. And you'd expect in a day and age like this where everybody is so sensitive to kind of take offense to Greinke. But the one thing that really stands out in my mind is when he was with Milwaukee, I believe, and he got traded by Milwaukee, there was a picture of him in the locker room after getting the news that he was traded, and just all of his teammates behind him with these huge smiles and obviously very happy that, you know, Zach was going somewhere to compete for a World Series title. And you could see that in that one frame, this genuine love. And this from a guy who, you know, if a player was crap that day, he would say it not as a matter of kind of like show him up or tell him. He was just being honest. That's just the way he is. Very interesting guy.
I love the sound. I mean, obviously, we've seen, you know, the reference that you've just made, JC, about sitting there watching the mound being reworked. But when you read up about him playing golf in flip-flops, and apparently he's a phenomenal golfer, hits a low handicap. Apparently he's really into scouting. There was one great story about at a young age. He had such a great talent for evaluating other players. He used to actually leave spring training and go to the Arizona State and watch guys for the draft. Then he'd go back, tell the manager about it. You've got to look at this guy. I love all that. But I think my favorite quote of all was Mark Tehan, who apparently said, this is a guy, he actually said to him one day after a game, man, you really had a bad game. As you said about, he can't lie. And I think one of his teammates described him as not a man in a million, man in 10 million. That's how special he is. They love him.
Everybody, you guys are missing him. You're missing the best story about Zach Greinke. So he's pitching in Puerto Rico, and his pitching coach tells him, you're going to throw 40 pitches in this game, throw 60% fastballs. He gets into the game, and he's on 38 pitches. He looks into the dugout. He throws a fastball up high and tight for a ball, and then throws for his 40th pitch a fastball on the black, on the corner for strike three. He's done for the day, exactly 40 pitches. The pitching coach looks in the book, 24 fastballs. He had done exactly 60%. So total, he was savant. Thinking about it. It's amazing. Yeah. I mean, that's about talent, but also a reason to love the guy. That it's not just that he'll be quirky and sit on the field, throw an Ephus pitch at 54 miles an hour, but that he really gets the game. And it's just, I'm a big fan. Trevor Bauer is a little more interesting, right? He's got his whole driveline thing, and he will really mix it up online. But I love miming drinking a beer on the mound. I mean, that's classic.
I think the beer company's come in and offered him some sponsorship deal, hasn't he?
They made the Cincinnati Buds cans, and he did a picture on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter with the can.
Yeah,
Lee could have done the same thing with maple syrup and marijuana.
Together. It's a special, special blend.
Maple Buds.
No, as well, because eccentric pitchers. For me, my childhood hero was Mark Fitterich of the Detroit Tigers. And that's the thing, as Josh was saying, characters of the game is what sort of opens people's eyes to the sport. When you have a character like Zach Greinke, like Mark Fitterich, like Trevor Bauer, it sort of piques your curiosity. And that's the thing. Brad Leslie was another example in the 80s of a quirky pitcher. There we go.
Hungarian.
Exactly. So, you know, it's and that's what we're missing a bit. We need more Zach Greinke's in the game. Joey Votto is another like character that's great for the game as well. It's sort of.
But I think pitchers, you know, we don't tend to embrace pitchers as much as positional players because they don't play every day. But some of them can be amongst the most interesting characters in the sport.
Carlos Perez, Expos.
That's true.
Bananas.
And
Pasquale. Don't forget Pasquale.
Pasquale, also in the Ephus pitch. Now, The final note, Zach Greinke, by the way, the last active player to have pitched against the Montreal Expos. Did you know that? Fact.
Did not know that. Very
right.
Nice.
Moving on, because we have Billy Bean to talk about. Billy Bean, of course, notorious for the book Moneyball. Billy Bean, notorious for the...
Why notorious?
Famous.
You're misusing.
I think notorious. Let's get.
Oh my God, we got the grammar police. On
here we go.
No, I think notorious because people are upset with Moneyball. Anyways,
I want to hear more about that after we talk about the story about why they're upset.
Exactly. If only it wasn't interrupted. Now, let's start again. The book Moneyball, the movie Moneyball, starring Brad Pitt, who plays Billy Bean, and now apparently we're trying to get Moneyball into the Premier League via Billy Bean. And David, tell us more.
Well, obviously Moneyball is about getting a lot out of a little. And apparently whatever happened in Moneyball with the A's has done a lot for Billy Bean, because all of a sudden him and a partner named Gary Cardinal, who's a sports-oriented banker, got himself 575 million big ones, just kind of sitting around ready to invest in football/soccer, whatever you want to call it. And I know there's been some talk about maybe he's buddies with the Fenway Sports Group, who own the Boston Red Sox, and Liverpool. Of course, Boston notoriously tried to sign or poach Billy Bean away from the A's way back when. And so they may be in cahoots in becoming partners in Liverpool. Billy Beane already had some involvement in soccer. He had a relationship with Barnsley, and he also was involved with a Dutch
AZ Alkmaar.
AZ Alkmaar, thank you very much, which is a consulting group. And so now, how'd you like to be in a position where you have $575 million and trying to figure out where to spend it? And, you know, I guess the big question is how open is the world of football / soccer towards statistical analysis? I know that this has been something that is up and coming, actually, in soccer. I can't even remember when soccer started its first statistical service, Opta Stats, and it's come a long way since that's begun. So we'll see where he lands, Josh.
You know, one of the unique things about baseball that makes it particularly ripe for these type of analytics is that individuals perform in many ways on their own within the team concept. So when you're up to bat, you don't have two people working on the same team to get that hit. It's a singular person, as opposed to a sport like football or American football or NBA, where there's so much interaction going on in every play. And so I know that there is definitely a place for analytics, but I wonder to what extent it can be as integrated and as useful. But my whole feeling about analytics, and the reason why I think that Moneyball is so misunderstood, is that really all Billy Beane was trying to do was trying to find undervalued markets. So places where people didn't think something was worth something, but actually got you a tremendous amount on the field. And that can be determined through analytics. That can be also determined through regular scouting, but it's about identifying those elements. So for example, one of those Moneyball elements that you don't think about from analytics is the idea of players being the ability for players on the baseball field to play multiple positions and what that value has. And that's not so much an analytics as identifying an undervalued market to get a player who is of a utility nature but can play every day and what that value has. So I think that that's sort of an issue that people kind of miss on Moneyball a lot.
Totally revolutionary. And Johnny, you'll remember, I remember it wasn't exactly Moneyball, but I remember back when John Barnes was playing and was such a key part of all those teams in Liverpool, they would talk about just the sheer number of touches and how much went through a player like John Barnes. And I remember hearing that very early. So it's interesting to see, you know, what else can be gleaned from, you know, trying to find undervalued line items in soccer.
I don't think anybody's quite done what Billy Beane did baseball, in certainly not in football or in rugby or in cricket or any of the sort of, you know, the British major sports. I don't think anybody's gone down that route to that sort of degree. And obviously he's already got a relationship with the Fenway Group, because if I remember rightly, in watching the movie, they did try and sign him, didn't they? Didn't they try and take him away from Oakland?
They did, yeah.
And of course he's a super fan of Liverpool, Billy.
Yeah, Beane. Massive football fan. You've met him, haven't you, Eric?
I have. No, actually, unfortunately, he supports Tottenham Hotspur.
No!
No, no, yes. You're wrong.
He's
a super fan for Liverpool.
Well, he's sort of converted. And when I spoke to him in 2007, he said he used to, when he
okay,
went
I
to,
interviewed him after that.
Okay, so well, see, that's the
what
thing.
What is this, Tom Trumps of interviews?
I see your 2007 interview, and I raise you.
I interviewed him, and so did my wife. Now. All right. So yeah, no, basically,
this is breaking news.
What's that?
This is breaking news. This is gossipy.
Well, no, basically,
the whole super fan Liverpool thing is a sham. He was a Spurs fan and changed out of convenience.
It was a business decision, most likely.
It's a business decision. That's gossip.
So yeah, so he used to when he used
conjecture.
To visit, when he used to visit his daughter, he said he told me he used to visit his daughter when she was studying at Cambridge, and before he booked a ticket, he said he'd look at where the Tottenham schedule was.
There you
and
go.
And sort of try to kill two birds with one stone, visit his daughter and see Spurs.
Guys, the man is an intelligent man. You can support Spurs for 2 or 3 years. Eventually, any intelligent man is going to decide, this is not for me. Let's find another team.
Here's the thing about this story, which is that there's conjecture that he's going to take a minority investment in Liverpool. And my feeling about that is, if he's going to put in $575 million, or whatever the number is, he's going to want to have a majority stake so that he has a real say in a team, because minority ownership's really fun for going to the luxury boxes and getting free tickets, but to actually have a real role, and he's even said, previous to this that, you know, with Liverpool, they already have a lot of people in place clearly who know what they're doing, that he's going to have to find another club where he can actually make his mark.
But is there not a conflict of interest issue here? Would he be allowed to have a majority stake in one team while he's still got an official role in another?
I presume he'd sell his stake in Barnsley, right? If he still has it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
There you go. And I'll say, the reason why it's so notorious, by the way, is a lot of people don't like the Moneyball formula.
It's not complicated.
Right? Guys, all you've got to focus on, if anybody makes a movie about you and they choose Brad Pitt to pretend to be you, you're a happy man.
When I asked him about that,
never going to happen.
When I asked him about that, I said, "What did your wife think when they casted Brad Pitt as you?" And he said, "Well, she laughed, but I thought they nailed it." And that's
fantastic.
Moving on, because there's stuff that's happening this week, and it is something to do with the trade deadline, Johnny.
Oh boy.
Yeah. You two have the really interesting, fun stories. Give me the dud one. Yeah, it's trade deadline on Monday, but it's a must-do. We've got to discuss it. It's going to be quieter than usual, guys. We know that. There's no Manny Makoda's going on because there are less sellers at the end of the day when you've got 16 teams in the playoffs. I mean, who's out of it? Who's out of it right now? Maybe Boston, Royals, Mariners, Rangers, Angels. In the National League, I'm saying only the Pirates. Only teams. Yeah. So not a lot of sellers.
They don't have much to sell.
No, exactly. And so I'm just going to mention a few quick names, guys, and then you pipe in with your own. But J.D. Martinez, a lot of people talking about. I don't see it happening. Too expensive. I think Jackie Brandley Jr. is more likely to leave Boston. Those that have gone, hitters, Tommy La Stella's gone for Angels to Oakland. Brett Phillip from Kansas City to Tampa Bay. Mitch Moreland, by the way, just been announced, literally as we started this broadcast, from Boston to the Padres. That's interesting. Eric Hosmer at first base. So he's obviously just there as sort of insurance, but that's an interesting trade. Not great for me, since I got Mitch Moreland in my team. He's not going to get his regular at-bats. Andrew Simmons and Christian Vasquez. That's an interesting one. Vasquez would be a definite upgrade for Tampa Bay at catcher. But I think most of the moves is going to be in the pitching arm, particularly the relief pitchers. Boston have got rid of Brandon Workman. He's gone to the Phillies, going to be their new closer. Matt Barnes is now the closer at Boston, but he might get traded. Trevor Rosenthal was mentioned in our add-on fancy pitch before he became the closer at KC. He's gone to San Diego. Will he still be the closer? There's questions about Tony Watson, other targets. Ken Giles is on the IL. Keon Keller's on the IL, but could be buy low candidates. You've got Josh Hader they're talking about. Never going to happen. He's a difference maker. He's at the Brewers. So what about starters? And this is the one area, guys, interested in your feedback. Tijon Walker has gone, and I think that's a great pickup for the Blue Jays. Got a win last night from Seattle. I think Nick Pivetta's gone as well from the Phillies to Boston. Not so major, but real different makers. Dylan Bundy from the Angels and Lance Lynn. A lot of talk about both of these two, and these are postseason difference makers in my view. Lance Lynn in particular could also be considered an ace. The Braves, the White Sox, the Twins, there's rumors that they might be interested. What's your thoughts?
I don't know why you said that was dull. You really, you nailed it.
Don't forget Clevinger. Clevinger too.
Yeah, there's talk about Clevinger and Zach Plesac, both the boys that have been on the naughty step at Cleveland. Zach Plesac, maybe, not Clevinger. I can't see them trading Clevinger.
I think you have to understand the contours of why this trading deadline is so weird, and you referenced one of them, Gouldy, which is that so many teams are in the race, but there are a couple other factors at play here, too. The second is that most teams have played just over 50% of their games. In a typical season, you're at about 67% of your games when you get to the trading deadline, so you're at a very different period. The second thing that you normally have in a regular season when you have 162 games is that you're going to have the player, if you get a rental, so a player who's going to be a free agent the next year, for a real large number of games. Even though we're only at 50%, you only get 30 games out of them. So you're getting very little bang for your buck if you're going to get a rental player. So that whole concept, which is a huge part of the trading deadline, is almost null and void. I don't see any big trades because of that. And I think to the extent that they will occur, they're going to occur at cut rates. And if I'm a team looking to sell, I'm thinking, I'm not going to get much out of this. Why even bother? So I think that that's the big issue.
Yeah. And would you not also accept...
Go ahead, Johnny.
Sorry, but Dave, just to pick up on what Josh has said about Dylan Bundy and Lance Lynn, the fact that they've still got a year and a half does mean that there's a little bit more value there for anybody that does trade for them. It's not just about the postseason this season.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think that's the reason you can get something. But in the end, you're going to probably not get as much back in return as you would have gotten if it were a regular season.
Sorry, Dave, you were going to say.
That's okay. It's fine. I'm not upset. It's fine. I'll have a hissy fit after the show. No, well, look, a couple of other factors. First of all, you know, there's no minor league baseball going on. So a lot of the prospects who we would have normally known a lot more about, not all of the teams have signed up to this kind of mutual scouting agreement. You can't scout in person. That's a big fact. You don't really have context of the players that are available because they're not playing minor league baseball games, and you can't openly watch them. Secondly is a little bit more abstract. Is how you have to ask yourself this question. In such a bizarre season, how much are teams willing to risk to win a championship where I don't want to say that teams don't want to win, because I think teams do want to win and they'll be happy if they do win. But it's not a normal season. Does winning a championship in this season mean as much to the organization? And I'll answer that in a couple of ways. I think there are some teams that really should not win the World Series this year, and that might be crazy to say. But the Indians, right? The Indians have been waiting since 1948 to win a World Series title. You don't want to win a World Series title in this scenario if you're waiting 78 years. I said the same thing about the Toronto Maple Leafs. If you're the Maple Leafs, I mean, you've been waiting since 67. This is not the way to do it in front of nobody in a neutral site. That's not how you want to break your streak. I think there are other teams that have less high stake. Like, imagine if the Cubs were breaking the 108 years or whatever it was, in a season like this in front of nobody, empty fans. That is not how you want to do it. I think the Dodgers need to do it. It's a little different, and we know that they are legitimate and they would have been there regardless of the length of the season. And I think smaller teams that would never have a chance in the world, legitimate, even a team like the Blue Jays, I think that would be fine. So I think the question is, how much are people willing to risk during a season that maybe in their minds isn't 100% quote unquote legitimate? And yeah, are we going to go to the well on that one?
It's a great point, and it's also a financial point, right? You're not going to get any of the gate, and I know gate isn't a huge part of the financial consideration nowadays the way it was in the past. But literally, the players will get their playoff money, but you're not going to get that nice amount of cash that would help offset potentially taking on a player who has a higher salary. So it's really more of a financial loss.
And what it does for a city when that happens. I mean, we've been to World Series. It just takes over the city, and people press come in from everywhere, and it's a huge event. And you know, that's not, you know, everybody's out and the bar scene
parades,
is huge.
No parades.
No parades. I mean, if you're the Indians, is this night you want to end that drought in this way? I don't know.
All right.
Thanks, Dave. I'm just going to go off and sit in a corner in a dark room because I'm so flippin' depressed as a result of all.
You do that most. You do that most Sundays,
watch our
don't
show.
You, Goldie?
Yeah,
it's your normal Sunday.
What's the point of watching baseball? It doesn't mean anything this season.
It doesn't even matter. Let's go.
It doesn't matter.
Now we'll have more next week.
Silly metal championship trophy.
All right.
We'll have more, obviously, on next week's show after the trade deadline closes. But we're moving on now, because now we're at the changeup, the cleanup batter, the final topic to have fun with here, which is the mascots in Major League Baseball. Is there a place for them now with no fans? Well, the Philly Fanatic seems to be still doing his shtick and his antics in empty stadiums. He's obviously doing it more for the cameras when it's for live broadcasted games. But has the mascot become redundant? May I also add that this is the 31st anniversary. And I don't know, it's not the 30th, but it's the 31st anniversary of
That's Yuppie. A big hook.
Yuppie, yes, yeah. Yuppie.
Nailed it, Eric.
The former mascot for the Montreal Expos, Yuppie.
Eric is holding up Yuppie for those.
I am holding up a Yuppie doll, by the way, which I own. Don't ask why. It's not inflatable. It's a family show. The 31 years ago this week, Yuppie was the first Major League Baseball mascot to be ejected from a Major League Baseball game by an umpire. It was against the Los Angeles Dodgers at the Olympic Stadium. And basically went to extra innings, and Yuppie was jumping up and down on top of the
Los Angeles Dodgers dugout, much to the annoyance of manager Tommy Lasorda, who stormed out of the dugout, yelled at Yupi, umpire ejects Yupi from the game. And the game actually went on to be to 22 innings, by the way. And
is that right? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I think the key here is that wasn't Yupi in his pajamas? And wasn't he lying down on the top as if, you know, this is so dull, you're so boring, you Dodgers, I'm going to sleep? And I think that's what seemed to upset Tommy.
A bit of both. He was sort of making noise and banging on the roof of the dugout. And,
it makes sense that the Dodgers wouldn't like it, right? They're one of only three teams without a mascot. Dodgers, Angels, and Yankees.
What, why is that, Jason?
And Cubs. Cubs, except Woo Woo is there was a guy called Woo Woo who would patrol the bleachers.
Woo Woo,
yeah, he was. I don't know if he's there anymore, but every game he was there in full Cubs uniform, walking around, and on the back of his shirt was called Woo Woo because he was Woo Woo the cheer like Yupi.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
My favorite mascot was the Astrodilla. There was an armadillo with like those orangey colors in the 1980s. There was Astro Jack, who was a rabbit, and then Astro Dilla. I mean, that was just – we jumped the shark at that point, and I loved it. It was just so bad it was good.
But aren't the best mascots always the ones that have something to do with the creator of the Muppets?
That is true, and that's – and obviously – and Yupi is one of them. Yupi actually
Billy
was created
Fanatic.
Was created by the Jim – somebody who worked with Jim Henson and Sesame Street and the Muppet Show.
Yeah. To create some historical.
Who's the best mascot of all time? I think it has to be the San Diego Chicken. No?
San Diego Chicken.
Well, he was really the original of this type of mascot. Although Mr. Met was an early.
Mr. Met's classic. But why don't we see the San Diego Chicken anymore? Why aren't the Padres all over with the San Diego Chicken? I don't see the San Diego Chicken anymore, and that's terrible. We need to bring
just
back.
To put some. Put some historical context on this, by the way. So mascots go back to like the 1910s. There was a bulldog that was a mascot for the Cleveland Naps. But that kind of off-field chicanery, that sort of like fun stuff, was such a huge part of baseball. Anyone who's seen Bull Durham, they mentioned Max Patkin, who was the clown prince of baseball, and he would do all this activity. The 1949 movie Take Me Out to the Ball Game that starred Gene Kelly and Frank Sinatra, they do a whole bit that really, you know, that movie's supposed to take place much earlier than that. And they do a whole bit of like kind of that kind of clown activity. So the idea of having someone off the field, even before these mascots began to really take shape and act in sort of a more cartoony way, really dates back to the early days of baseball.
But what's Tommy Lasorda's problem with mascots? He hasn't just had a run-in with Yupi. He beat up Philly Fanatic. There's great footage on the internet.
That's because Tommy Lasorda wanted to be part manager, part mascot himself. Like, he was one of those larger-than-life characters who was always trying to be, like, the center of funny. So,
and attention.
Baseball, this is a topic for another show, but baseball needs more Tommy Lasordas. I mean, we have the most vanilla crop of managers we have ever seen in our entire lives. We used to have incredible, entertaining managers who were always great for an awesome quote, and now we've got nothing.
Earl
Let's
Weaver.
Save it.
Yeah. We can do a thing on managers at some point.
Yeah, let's do a thing on that.
Moving on. Also, by the way, there is a UP Wikipedia page, by the way. Mm-hmm. And I have no idea how this happened. And people accuse me that
this is
I
your
was
most shameless possible. Name drop of all time, Aaron.
No. It's basically, if you go to the Wikipedia page, if you go to the Wikipedia page for UP, I swear I have no idea how that photo of me and UP became, and that's Yupi's profile pic. I'm actually in the same profile pic as Yupi in the Wikipedia page.
And you know, that's because you were drunk when you put it up. That's why you have no idea.
And Eric, the question that all the viewing fans are going to be asking when they check this Wikipedia page out is which one of the two is the biggest Muppet?
All week, Gouldy has been waiting, just champing at the bit for this moment.
He's supposed to say, come on, give it to me.
Give it to me.
Moving on. So that ends our mascots debate. Let us know, email in, use our social handles and whatever else, smoke signals you want to do. Which is your favorite Major League Baseball mascot and why?
Thank you, Eric. Right, well, it's time for interview, an exciting interview it is. We mentioned at the top of the show, Ray Doswell is the Vice President and Curator of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in Kansas City in this very, very special week, and actually really sad week, because, of course, it's also the passing of Chadwick Boseman, who played Jackie Robinson in the movie 42. But what a great opportunity for us to touch base with Ray, and it was Dave that spoke with the legend that is the Vice President and Curator of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum.
It's a pleasure to welcome Ray Doswell with us, who is the Vice President and Curator of the Negro Leagues Museum in Kansas City. Ray, thank you for joining the Johnny and Josh Show.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
It's been a historic week for social justice and sports in the United States, as we all know. We will discuss that, but I'd like to, if it's okay, begin with the Negro League Museum, quite the institution. For those who don't know, tell us a little bit about the museum and its mission.
Well, actually, officially the museum anniversary is September 1990. Some of our offices opened in 91. So this is our 30th anniversary year, with life-size bronze statues and hundreds of photographs and artifacts related to African-American baseball from the late 1800s up through the 1960s. And we emphasize what was called the Professional Negro Leagues, which lasted from 1920 to 1960. And we typically, in an average year, this is an unusual year, of course, we welcome close to 60 to 70,000 visitors through our turnstiles to learn the history of African-Americans in sport and how it connects to the larger Black history story and American history story. And it's hard to deny that, you know, the reason for the existence of the Negro Leagues is because back in those years, it was because of racism and segregation that kept African-American players out. But MLB understands the pain of that history and wants to rectify that through the support of the museum and other initiatives that support African-Americans wanting to participate in the sport. I can't say enough about the players wanting to embrace the history. In a normal year, we would have players coming through as they're traveling to Kansas City and they want to learn the history. And I think they've been embracing this history more and more and understanding it. And not just African-American players, but white players and important to us too, Latino players, understanding their connections to this great past.
What does it mean to you personally to be part of an institution that's become kind of a almost like a baseball pilgrimage for sports and for education, to see players coming through and learning about the legacies of players such as Josh Gibson and Satchel Paige and Jackie Robinson. Perhaps more importantly, though, the players that we don't know because they could not make it to the major leagues despite having the talent.
Well, it's very rewarding work for me. I think a lot of people who I encounter think I have one of the sexiest jobs in the world. I get to be around baseball and occasionally get to meet celebrities and other things. And that's true, that does happen. But the day-to-day grind of actually answering history questions and filing photographs and doing research, it's work like anything else. At the same time, the rewards come from when people do recognize that we're contributing something very important to the national discussion about understanding African-American history, and that sports fans are awakened to something that they didn't know anything about, and that people come in, they see the history, and they appreciate what we do. But when people say that they appreciate the experience, they appreciate the beauty of our museum, they appreciate what we're doing, it does make you feel good. It's very rewarding. And I hope that beyond this occasion of the centennial, that folks remember those lessons and continue to pass those down to young people and come back and, of course, support the museum in our vital work.
You spoke about history, obviously, throughout the United States. This has been a historic week for social justice, in particular the involvement and the role that sports is playing. We've seen boycotts on Thursday. The Mets and the Marlins walked off the field after bowing their heads for 42 seconds, which was a nod to Jackie Robinson, who, of course, wore 42. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on these events.
Well, it is a very poignant watershed moment in American history. And yet, we've been here before, and those who study history understand that. But I'll try to explain. So here at the museum, we've been involved in these conversations for a long time as content providers of understanding the backdrop to social justice and systemic racism in America. Not that we are experts in that, and in understanding the broader sociological and anthropological issues tied to that, but we have a story to tell. And that story is of how African Americans in mostly urban settings were able to manage racism and oppression, and what I like to say, broker their culture and their abilities to great success. And in doing so, through sport, help pave the way for integration in America. And we think too that sport can be, for a lot of people, a safe entree into discussing these issues. But what the players and the athletes have done, and particularly this week, really puts it in the face of people to pay attention. And I hope they can continue playing, but I completely understand the need for a pause. And if that pause means taking any distractions away from that issue, which is, I think, their goal, then folks hopefully will wake up and see that message and truly pay attention, not feel inconvenienced. These players are human beings with feelings and want to see real change in America.
And you hope that events like this open the door to real change. Having said that, we are recording this podcast on what is the rescheduled Jackie Robinson Day. That's Friday. Also coincides, as you mentioned, with the 57th year anniversary of the March on Washington and Dr. Martin Luther King. All at the same time that we tip our caps to Jackie Robinson and recognize what he did for African Americans in baseball and sport and society, baseball seems to be going in a kind of neutral to downward direction when it comes to presence of players and managers and upper management in baseball today. It's about 8% players on the field is the statistic cited. And back in 1981, the numbers and representation would have been, in and around three times that. Why are we down from 1981? Why aren't we triggering up representation amongst African Americans?
That's a very good question. And every Jackie Robinson Day, no matter what time of year it is, we get asked that question. And I've never claimed expertise on reasons. I could tell you a lot of factors, a lot of things go into it. The part that for some, when they come to the baseball museum, is that they can see on the walls in our museum the number of black fans, the number of black players, black owners, black business people who love the game and invested in the game and were invested heavily in the game itself. And black people have a stake in this game historically. And that should not be denied. And for African Americans, we hope that they will see themselves in the game in that way. They certainly can hearken back to it historically. And they have a great stake in this game, just like they have a great stake in the building of our country. Historically speaking, though, as I noted earlier, it's a shame that the Negro Leagues had to exist in the first place. But thank God for the Negro Leagues, as former Commissioner Faye Vincent had been credited to saying, because then the talented black athlete at least had a pathway to baseball as a result. it's very possible that a Jackie Robinson could have, if he wanted to, play in the NFL. It's very possible that a Willie Mays could have played another sport. Many of these ball players played basketball. Had it not been for the success of the Negro Leagues to nurture that talent, or the success of Jackie Robinson when he came on the scene, to have success, we would not have some of the greatest players of all time to come immediately after that. And I know the impact is strong. When you have, for example, for me, working here in the museum, occasionally working in the gift shop, and a young white couple comes in with their beautiful 2-year-old baby or 3-year-old baby who's walking on her own, and I can say hi to that young child and say, what is her name? We named her Satchel, after the great Leroy Satchel Paige. and they have respect for Satchel Paige and Willie Mays, and the impact socially that they had is as important, in my opinion, more important than any stat or league designation you can make for them.
Fair enough. Well, Ray, I want to thank you for coming on with us and spending some time with the Johnny and Josh podcast. That is Ray Doswell, the vice president and curator of the Negro League Museum in Kansas City, Missouri. Ray, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brilliant stuff, and huge thanks to Ray for doing that. And for those of you that enjoyed that, do check out the add-on, though. We're going to have the whole interview that Dave did with Ray Doswell, and that'll be available via our various social media handles. Of course, Johnny and Josh, the Johnny and Josh Show on Facebook, and Johnny and Josh, at Johnny and Josh, that is, on Instagram and on Twitter. So do check that out. Dave, I have such fond memories of our road trip in 2008. We did so many, very many special things on our road trip, but when we got the private tour of the Negro League Baseball Museum in Kansas City, that's definitely one of my all-time highlights, especially with everything that's going on in the world. How lovely was that to chat with the legend?
Look, he knows just about everything there is to know about the Negro Leagues and its history and its vital place in baseball and sports and the fabric of the country, frankly. And I found it very insightful, and there's even more to learn. And I would encourage anybody who is in Kansas City to stop by that museum. It is becoming a pilgrimage site for sports. And as I mentioned in the interview, it started as a little one room kind of facility, and now it's 10,000 square feet. So I think everybody should get out there and take a look and try to learn as much as they can.
JC, if you're a baseball fan from this part of the world and you want to go to the States and check out a stadium, go to a game, you know, when you're running out that list of must-see sites, you know, Cooperstown obviously comes to mind, your own ballpark comes to mind, but where does the Negro League Museum sit in all that?
The Negro League Museum needs to be at the top of the list of places that you go to. It's such an amazing place, and it's such a real receptacle of history, and it's also a reminder of the systemic racism that we have in the United States and how heartbreaking it was. Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier should have been a moment for celebration for every single American. It was a step in the right direction for one of the biggest stains in American history. But at the same time, what was happening is that all these players were starting to move into the major leagues, is that it led to the end of the Negro Leagues, which employed so many African Americans, which led to all of these African American businesses, and so many people who were working there effectively lost their jobs. So you saw that it had such a tough impact on the African American community from that standpoint, even while it was doing so much to uplift it in a cultural sense when we had integration.
One of my favorite things, actually, one of the most fascinating things from that museum visit when we went, guys, was when the curator actually pointed out a poster that, which I couldn't believe, I couldn't fathom. There's actually a game between some Negro players and the Ku Klux Klan. Mind-boggling.
Wow.
We'll post it up on one of our social handles, that a game that you can't believe that actually occurred. But yes,
wow. That's incredible. Wow. I had no idea about that.
Well, let's hope the Negro League All Stars gave them a right good kicking in a baseball sense.
Moving on to the seventh inning stretch, we're going to continue our chat, of course. And this stretch actually allows me to show off which shirt I'm wearing, which obviously you can't tell on audio, but you'll be able to check out our social handles. I'm actually wearing the Montreal Royals jersey, the one that actually Jackie Robinson used to wear. when he was at his, doing his time at Montreal. Montreal, the city of Montreal, is very proud of his history of helping the Dodger organization of getting Jackie Robinson into Major League Baseball. They decided to send him off to the affiliate, their farm system up in Montreal. And basically, we're going to start off with, we cannot do our movie of the week without mentioning the movie 42. And tragically, that, of course, is very appropriate. We were actually going to talk about 42 last week on our show, but we decided to do it this week. And sadly, this week, the actor who portrayed Jackie Robinson passed away.
Yeah, heartbreaking. Chadwick Boseman, fantastic actor. You know, the movie itself was pretty forgettable, to be quite honest. I thought it was a little bit of a disappointing film, but his portrayal of Jackie Robinson was just reflective of what a great actor he was. He was, you know, poignant. He was fantastic in that movie, and it was the one standout in a movie that otherwise could have been a lot better considering the subject matter.
I love the movie, I have to tell you. It rang quite personal for me because my father is a Brooklyn Dodgers fan, converted to an LA Dodgers fan. And so the day the movie came out, I got all excited. I woke up and I did like a tour of Brooklyn of Jackie Robinson spots. I went to his house in East Flatbush. I went to the diner where he hung out with the Dodgers. I went to Ebbets Field's apartments, the former site of Ebbets Field. And of course, down the block from where I lived, two sites, one where he signed with Branch Rickey, the contract. The building doesn't exist anymore, but of course the space is still there. And the Bossert Hotel, I snuck into an under-construction Bossert Hotel to go up to the roof where the Dodgers partied after they won the World Series in 1955. So I was all about getting ready to go and watch 42. And I have to think that the thing that stands out, apart from the portrayal of Jackie Robinson, which was incredible, is growing up in a household where we always heard about, you know, being in New York City, always heard about Ebbets Field, always heard about the Polo Grounds and the incredible special effects that they did to take us inside these ballparks that we heard so much about growing up, and the Dodgers and the Bums, and every day, you know, Dad never stops. And to finally be able to kind of almost be inside that ballpark for me was incredible. And I do like the movie a lot. I think they did a wonderful job. And performances were special.
But guys, do you think that the movie suffers from the fact that it is such an important subject? And he's such an iconic personality that unless it was a brilliant movie, it just wasn't doing that grand story the justice that it deserved?
Yeah, I feel that way, Goldie. I feel that there are so many nuances, and it was such a complicated time that when it gets distilled down to some other, you know, the other team, Philadelphia Phillies, razzing him and using racial epithets, that it almost sort of, in a way, minimizes. It makes it more like a TV movie. It's just like a very more simplistic look at something that required much more depth. And they didn't do a terrible job. I'm never going to criticize anyone. I haven't done any movies, so what am I to say? But I think it could have been better.
Basically, that's exactly. Look, it's a good movie, but it could have been better. And it's still a recommendation. C-42.
I like it.
It made Chadwick Boseman's career. His performance made his career. And it's so sad to see that no one knew about his illness. Apparently, he's been ill for 4 years and made, what, four or five movies in that time? And apparently, such a great guy, you know, did so many with foundations, with charities. It's a really sad, sad story this week.
If you want to see a movie that looks at and depicts some of the Negro League experience, and this film isn't nuanced either, but it's a really fun film. Bingo Long and his traveling all-stars and Motor Kings starred James Earl Jones, Billy Dee Williams, and Richard Pryor. And it's a great film. It was actually produced by Berry Gordy, who is the famed founder of Motown. And it's a fun film that sort of looks at the barnstorming part of the Negro Leagues.
So basically, Chadwick Boseman, rest in peace, and C-42, make your own mind up. It still is a must-see film. Moving on to the baseball books of the week. Of course.
Here we go, JC. Here we go. Oh, no.
Well, I got to do the Jackie Robinson autobiography.
Yeah. And this is the one week I respect Eric totally snubbing me.
It's got to be done. Obviously, if you got to read about the Jackie Robinson's autobiography, this is one of the books that I can recommend. But Josh, of course, we had a discussion before we went on the show. There was also another book that's a must read dealing with Jackie Robinson trying to break the color barrier.
So which one is yours? What was the full name of it?
For those in audio, I never had it made. The Jackie Robinson autobiography is this week's baseball book of the week.
I think the best book ever written about Jackie Robinson and about this period that was groundbreaking at the time it came out was Baseball's Great Experiment by Jules Tigel. It was a fantastic book, and it really is one that you should read if you want to get the full scope of the history.
That's right. So obviously, I Never Had It Made is one recommendation of Jackie Robinson breaking the color, but also like to just throw in Larry Doby as well. The Larry Doby biography written by Joseph Thomas Moore, because people don't really know this. Larry Doby played in the American League. So while Jackie Robinson was being racially abused and heckled in every single National League ballpark, 3 months later, Larry Doby made his debut for the Cleveland Indians in the American League. So he had to go through the same abuse in different ballparks. Of course, don't forget pre-interleague. So basically, Jackie Robinson was racially abused in National League ballparks, and Larry Doby had to go through the same horrors in American League ballparks in the same.
With none of the pop.
Exactly. And people don't actually think of Larry Doby as another one who broke the color barrier, but only in the American League.
Except that one song, Cleveland's Got Larry Doby, Brooklyn's Got Jackie Robinson. You know that song? We'll have to play it on the air. I'll get it for you.
We shall.
Guys, should we mention Branch Rickey and obviously his big role here? Because he was a real innovator. I mean, not just the breaking of the color barrier, but other stuff that he did as well in terms of spring training and the farm system. JC, I mean, this man was extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, he was the proto-analyst. He was Moneyball before Moneyball. He had hired a guy with Brooklyn whose job it was to crunch numbers in a similar way to a lot of the work that was done in analytics decades after. He was an amazing figure in baseball. He was forward-thinking. He was very talented. I don't know if we have mentioned that it was Jackie Robinson Day on Friday. It was mentioned in David's interview. But beyond that, we should mention the reason for that was when Branch Rickey actually had his meeting with Jackie Robinson to actually sign him, and that was on that day.
Right.
Exactly.
Branch Rickey, favorite quote. I can't say for sure. I think this was salary negotiations with Ralph Kiner, I think, when he was in Pittsburgh. The Pirates were an extremely bad ball club at the time. Ralph Kiner wanted more money, if I've got this right. Branch Rickey said, I finished last with you. I can finish last without you. I think that's Rickey.
Moving on to television references, baseball and pop culture and television. I actually had to ask Johnny if I wasn't sure if the United Kingdom was into Fantasy Island during the 70s.
Yeah, baby.
But
Ricardo Montalban,
Hervé
Villachez.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So Fantasy Island was, it was one of those shows which, of course, it was an island where they would fulfill your fantasies in a clean way. And the
so it wasn't in the British Virgin Islands.
So basically, family show. In 1978, in season one of Fantasy Island, there was an episode where Gary Berghoff, yes, Gary Berghoff of MASH fame, the guy who portrayed Radar O'Reilly in MASH, the actor actually appears in Fantasy Island, and his fantasy was to play Major League Baseball or play baseball with top stars. And there's an episode where you actually have Tommy Lasorda, George Brett, his brother Ken Brett, Ellis Valentine of the Montreal Expos, by the way, Fred Lynn, cast of thousands, in this one episode. Steve Garvey was in this episode where they play baseball.
How they get all those people down there? What a coordinated
exactly. The plane. Oh, by the way, Hervé Villachez wore in a San Francisco Giants cap. See what they did there? Yeah. So it was
one of those. That's 1978 for you.
Yeah,
You look at the episode, and of course, what did I say? What do we love? We love it so bad it's good. It's got to be seen. We're going to post the link of that episode of Fantasy Island with a cast of thousands. By the way, Ken Brett, who's George Best's brother, is in that episode. People say Ken Brett.
Great hitter.
Insignificant.
Great pitching hitter. One of the best hitting pitchers.
But not just that, but people also overlook, he is the youngest pitcher to ever pitch in a World Series at 19 years old.
Wow.
One of the worst trades, involved in one of the worst trades ever, deadline trades. It was Doc Ellis, Willie Randolph, and Ken Brett for this, oh God, for a pitcher for the Pirates who was from Pittsburgh, and Pittsburgh fell in love with this guy.
Was it Doc Medich? Was it
Doc Medich? Yeah. Pittsburgh, he had punted for Pittsburgh in for college football, and Pittsburgh fell in love with this guy. They traded for him. They blew 13 years of writing Willie Randolph's name at second base. They had they traded away Doc Ellis, and Ken Brett was in that deal. So, little side there.
There you go. Ryan, end of seventh inning stretch. Now we move on to the trivia answer. Now, you guys remember, I don't know if you were cogitating in your heads or not, since I posed a question, which was this. Which player in the past 20 years has had the most consecutive games played?
I'm going to go with Hideki Matsui.
So I said was it A, Hideki Matsui?
Very aggressive,
John. Was it B, A-Rod?
Got to do what you got to do. Yeah, this is all every person for themselves. I feel like we're on like Lord of the Flies Island. I got the conch.
Or was it C, Prince Fielder?
How embarrassing is it going to be when I'm wrong, though, Dave? Right?
It's not Prince Fielder. It can't be Prince Fielder.
Okay, so here we go.
It can't be, which means it is.
Can I, for our viewers and the listeners, can I repeat the options?
Go ahead, please. Yeah, thank you.
Was it A, Prince Fielder, B, Hideki Matsui, or C, A-Rod? Josh is going with Hideki Matsui, who's played the most consecutive games in the past 20 years.
Since I want to go out. Matsui, too.
We can all go Matsui.
You can go Matsui, right, too.
Goldie.
Okay, I'm going Matsui.
Dave, who are you going to go for?
I'm going to go Fielder because it seems unlikely. And by the way, I don't know if the suspensions, do they break up a streak? Suspensions?
Look, I'm just
looking for loopholes. You sound like Goldie.
I have the answer. So, are you committing to Prince Fielder?
I'm going to go Prince Fielder because it seems completely ridiculous.
No,
okay,
I think it's possible.
So,
but he was very healthy for a time.
In the past 20 years, the players who have played the most consecutive games in Major League Baseball.
Drum roll.
A-Rod was 546.
Okay.
Wow.
Prince Fielder was 547.
Wow.
It's going to be Matsui.
Hideki Matsui was 519. Prince
nice.
Fielder.
You see what he did there?
He did.
I didn't go reversing order, did
Very
I?
Very unpredictable.
Nice.
Now, just by the way, just a throwaway comment: the current active player with the most consecutive games played.
Oh God.
Whose streak is still going? Who's probably trying is Whit Merrifield of the Kansas City Royals.
Oh,
at the
yeah.
time of this recording, I believe he's at 274 consecutive games in a row.
Wow.
So if he stays healthy for the next 15 years, he can probably – and plays all 162 games. Forget the 60-game schedule here. He's lost 102 games this year. Whit Merrifield is the next likely candidate at the
That's
moment.
Great. I'm going to follow
break
that.
Cal Ripken, and Thank apparently you. Cal Ripken Jr. tweeted him at the beginning of the season saying, it gets easier after 300.
it's never nice. Going to happen. Baseball record,
happen.
Guys, baseball record never
gonna
will never
happen.
Be beaten.
Especially
never be beaten.
In this day and age.
2,632, 16 and a half years of baseball. Never going to happen.
Well, we didn't have lats back when Cal Ripken Jr. played.
Yeah.
They didn't exist.
No, there were no oblique injuries. There was no
Yeah,
such
no
thing.
Obliques.
Yeah.
Exactly. Now, exactly. Moving on to the mailbag, because we got the postman has been, Johnny.
I have indeed, buddy, and a huge thanks to everybody getting in touch. Don't forget Facebook, The Johnny and Josh Show, on Instagram and Twitter, at Johnny and Josh. Just say hi, tell us whatever you want to tell us or ask a question. I just want to give Charlie Baldwin a big mention. Charlie, whose Twitter strap is at Baseball Chaz, he just did his first broadcast on the in-play runs hosted by at MLB UK Community, and a massive thanks to Dave Shaw and all the team getting involved in that. If you haven't seen or listened, they literally, guys, they do the equivalent of Jeff Stelling. They basically broadcast for 5 hours one Sunday night, and they keep flying to different guys who are saying what's happening in different games. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, I watched it too, Goldie. It was a ton of fun.
It was a ton of fun. It really was. And I think the next episode is planning to be on either Sunday the 6th or Sunday the 13th. So keep your eyes out for that, guys. Do check that out at MLB UK Community. Thanks to Charlie. Thanks to Dave. Now, well, Charlie actually put in a very quick question. Who's more likely to go further in the playoffs, boys, presuming they make it, Padres or White Sox? Dave?
Oh, wow. I really love what the White Sox are doing. I mean, I know I'm not alone in that department. Two obviously very talented teams that are ahead of schedule. I would say that it would be the Padres only because the National League is so much weaker than the AL. It gives an opportunity for an upstart club like the Padres.
Okay. We've got another question on Facebook from Aiden Wiley. JC, who's the biggest incompetent, Rob Manfred or Brody Van Wagenen? Great question.
I think that's a photo finish that can never be determined.
Wow.
They are in the hall of ignominy, both of them. I mean, okay. We haven't even talked about Brody this week and the whole issue with the Wilpons and statements about games being replaced. They are just a dumpster fire. And Manfred's got a lot of work to do, too.
Eric Edward Ditchfield, who's a regular contributor. Thank you, Edward. What's your most surreal memory experience associated with baseball? He says, mine is trying to explain the game, or Yankee Rounders, as this bloke called it, to a friend of mine with an unnatural love of cricket on my pub quiz team. He decided to smack my lucky baseball against his head with force to see how hard it was. Yeah, it was hard, he said, then sat there in a daze for the rest of the night, mumbling about Carol Vorderman. As you do. Eric, most bizarre experience, surreal memory of baseball?
By the way, Carol...
I thought you were going to ask him what his most biggest memory of Carol Vorderman was.
By the way, she's still got it. She's still got it.
Still got it. There's nothing natural there, Eric. Move on.
Oh, stop it. One for the top, two for the bottom, please. it's a family show. What was the question?
Because the most surreal experience in baseball?
I know, because you went into the whole like, the guy threw a surreal. I'll tell you what a surreal experience in baseball. David was there actually, but it's going to be for another show. It's David and I coming out of the elevator in New Yankee Stadium, out of the press box elevator, and being told by Secret Service that we can't go any further because Michelle Obama was walking by and Yogi Berra was walking by as well.
I remember that.
And we had to, and as ourselves, the Secret Service didn't know who we were, but also there were two guys who were standing with us, and they were told, you stay with those guys. So it was David Lengel, Eric Jansen, Bernie Williams, and Paul O'Neill.
Wow.
You cannot go any further than this.
Fantastic. World Series winners.
And then we had a chat with I had a chat with Yogi Berra. David went off to get a sandwich. And
great. I blew that one.
That sounds like it's flip-flopped is what you would expect, right?
It was bizarre. Yes, it was that's my most surreal moment.
We've also had a few questions in on Twitter. Massive thanks to Bobito, Nick Wiseman, Ian Blees, Liz Britton, regular contributors. I want to move Richard Swan at Swanny Billick. Mentioned a lot of chatter about the workload on pitchers, but not so much about hitters. Teams such as his Cards, the Marlins, the Phillies, suffering day-to-day stuff, muscle soreness, fatigue, jaded. All, of course, JC, because they're having to play so many games in such a short period. And I think particularly with regards to the Cards, which is his team, Richard's got a good point.
I think the bigger issue is that you're getting players not playing as many games because you'll play a doubleheader and someone like Colton Wong, for example, he'll not play in both games. So I think it's less about being tired and more about having to really work in your bench a lot more.
Last one, quick.
Okay, well, huge thanks to everybody getting in touch. I've also got one from Peter Ramsey at Boris1873 on Twitter. He says, do you think next season they'll stick to 7 innings for doubleheaders, or will they go back to the traditional 9?
They're going
to
go back to 9 because doubleheaders are a rarity. You don't need to do the 7-inning games in order to keep it moving the way you do this year. So I think the bigger issue is extra innings and whether they're going to actually make that change, because I think a lot of people are actually surprisingly liking starting with the player on second.
And that's the end of this week's mailbag.
Thank you very much, Erica. Thank you to everybody that got in touch. Guys, do check out the Facebook site, the Johnny and Josh Show, and, of course, on Twitter and Instagram, at Johnny and Josh. We do want to hear from you. It doesn't have to be a question. If you need us to advertise with regards to what's happening in your part of the world here in the UK, we're here for you. This is a UK baseball podcast, so thank you for those that do make the effort, and we look forward to hearing from you for next week's show and beyond. But that brings the show to a close, boys.
Already?
Don't forget to mention, I know, can you believe it? It's just flown past. Don't forget the fancy baseball add-on, James Holden, ladies and gentlemen. And Eric, I'm loving that top. The Montreal, the 42, in honor of the legend that was Jackie Robinson. Guys, any add-ons that you want to come in with?
No, just that I have that Montreal jersey, but for Roberto Clemente. People don't remember that Roberto Clemente played for the Montreal Royals before being a Rule 5 draft pick for the Pittsburgh Pirates. So Jackie wasn't the only great to play in that jersey that Eric Amazing. Is showing to us and no one else because we're a radio podcast.
Imagine the Dodgers with Clemente. Good Lord.
Yeah.
Stacked.
And there's the great Clemente Award, isn't it, that's given out every year?
Absolutely.
Because he was a great guy. Well, there you go. We've got three great guys on the show and me, and it's great to have you with us on the podcast in a very, very special week that of Major League Baseball. Let's hope we're COVID-free next week for the very first time. Guys, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you, everybody, for listening. We look forward to having your company on the Johnny and Josh Show with Big Dave and Big Eric next week, same time, from us all. Bye-bye.